This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows a path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, a pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Thank you, Venerable, and over to you.
Thank you. Well, one of the big questions that I come across a lot is, how do we know how this path works? How do we know we're moving forward in the right direction? How do we know that we're putting all this effort in and it's actually working? And this is a very big question that affects so many of us. And because we spend sometimes many years dedicated to this path, we really start to get these doubts and fears and concerns that is this, maybe we're wasting our time, maybe we're doing this all wrong, who knows? Actually, there is a way we can tell, and it is how the path develops on its own. It's a bit tricky on some levels because no two of us are alike. We have many things in common, but our path always develops in our own way. And so that gives us a good step forward to be able to recognize that the middle way for us as individuals will be different to each other. It will be very similar, but, you know, the amount of seasoning that you need will always be just right for you. And the way that it usually goes forward is when we start practicing, studying texts, maybe hearing Dharma talks, maybe practicing meditation, we start to get an idea exactly what the Buddha's teaching is. Four Noble Truths, the Middle Way, all these other things that we put in that are in the text, as well as that we talk about, these things gradually start to make a bit of sense intellectually. We start to remember them. We start to apply them in daily life. And we catch ourselves in a little moment going, oh, this is what the Buddha said. Oh, yeah, I remember this. This starts to make more sense. Or we have meditation experiences as well. And these start to come in and going, oh, yeah, I read about this in a text, or I heard about this from this teacher or that teacher. And, you know, we start to get more confidence in what the Buddha said because these things start to make sense intellectually. And that's a good step in the first direction. And it usually always requires that to happen. For us to start our mindfulness practice, we really need to know what we have to be mindful of. So this initial study is a really important thing. The problem is, you know, there's that old saying that a little bit of knowledge can be a dangerous thing. And unfortunately, it is the case here as well. The intellectual understanding that is so important and gives us so much confidence can be misleading, because it's not actually the thing we're studying itself. The whole point of the intellectual is that it's an understanding of an idea. It's not the thing itself. In Buddhism, there's this term, yathābhūta ñāṇadarśana, which literally means seeing and knowing things as they really are. And it's a very active sense, so it means as they are happening. So what that means is that while things are happening in our daily life, all of a sudden these teachings come into our awareness. We remember this, we remember this, we remember this skillful means, how to handle these emotions, how to, you know, relax, how to focus, how to do all these things that the Buddha teaches. And these skills, again, start to develop more into real life skills. The danger, of course, is it's a very human thing. We want to feel that we're practicing. We want to feel that we've got it. We want to feel that this is it. And so we can sometimes mislead ourselves in thinking that our intellectual understanding is good enough. Our intellectual understanding is it, which can be a bit of a problem. You know, we can end up being so afraid that we haven't actually got it, that we start to convince ourselves that we have. And we can start to read the text and to listen to things with the belief that we already know. You know, we're already, you know, a stream enter or whatever. And there is at times perhaps a little bit of this fear of missing out. We want to be part of this group of practitioners, this part of this group of stream enterers, even arahats. We might even give ourselves labels and claim that we are these, you know, practitioners who have reached these deep insights. And yet we haven't done that at all. But we're so afraid that we haven't, we can mislead ourselves. And we end up going in circles. So the good thing is understanding that this intellectual understanding is really useful for us. And we don't have to get stuck into this. By this yathābhūta ñāṇadarśana, seeing things as they really are, we start to come more into the moment, more into the experience. And it's not just seeing it, which is mindfulness, but knowing it as well. And that's where these things really start to come together. And that's when we can really sort of feel that the practice is working, because it's happening now. It's not something we have to think about. It just happens all on its own. But as the practice goes on, we still need to go a bit further as well. And that starts to go inwards. We've spoken before about how the Buddha takes certain separate ideas and he kind of welds them together to make two thought ideas into one. Sati Sampajanya is an example of this, mindfulness and wisdom, where these two now come together and inform each other and work together. Another one of these is this term Samatha and Vipassana. And these are two things which in the early Buddhist texts you find all the time, are two things welded together. Vipassana literally means to see clearly. It's from the verb pasati, to see. And it's got the vi sort of prefix, which can be a little bit confusing because that can kind of mean the opposite, as in not seeing, but it can also mean fully, which is a bit confusing, but it really means to see clearly, to see fully. But in order to see fully, you have to have a clear mind. And to clear the mind, you need to still the mind. So that's where the samatha comes in. So the more and more we relax the mind, the more and more we can see clearly. And of course, this is, you know, always a challenge. We've got so many worries, we're so tired, we're so burnt out, we're so busy, we've got all these things we've got to think about and worry about and get us upset and angry and so on. And when we're in this really turbulent state of mind, we can't think clearly. And that's just how it is. And that's where the meditation starts to come in. So we don't meditate to achieve anything. We just meditate simply to see clearly. Which is a wonderful thing, because it all of a sudden, the need to be something, the need to be perfect, the need to fall into all these, you know, magical methods and techniques and stuff that we were telling ourselves we have to do. It's very liberating to just be able to rest in our meditation, to rest in the breath, or to rest in the loving kindness, to rest in whatever meditation you do. And that settles the mind. Because, of course, we can't see clearly if our mind is cloudy, or if it's muddled, or if it's dirty, or whatever word you want to use. And it happens all on its own, which is so wonderful. But as we start to go more clearly, we start to realize these vested interests and these conflicts of interest, and that there's this barrier here where it's going, yes, you can do all this practice, but no, you know, we're going to stop you at some point. And it's because deep, deep down, our mind and our body fully understands the chaos, the impermanence, the change, the uncertainty, that everything is out of control, that we get a grip on something and it will slip through our fingers. It understands that, and it's afraid of that, and it doesn't know how to deal with that. And that really is the human condition. So what we do is we build up a fortress within ourselves. We put up firewalls, all these barriers to keep all this out. Because it looks at the world and it says, we can't deal with this. No, you know, it shuts it out. And to cope, to survive, to function, we build up a story, a fortress, everything so we can function. And most human beings are in this. Problem is, it's very useful to navigate the world, but it's also a prison. This fortress is not a palace. It's a prison. And we're trapped in it. And that's painful too. So the mind is stuck both ways. It's trying to deal with all this stuff of daily life, of existence, and yet it's being stuck inside where it feels safe. It's also deeply unpleasant. And because it doesn't know how to deal with this, it doesn't know better, which is this thing avijja, a very important term in Buddhism, this not knowing, which as far as the Buddha is concerned, it's at the root of the whole problem. We don't know how to deal with this. We continue to do all these things to protect ourselves. And at times, you know, who cares about the price? Because the fortress does its job, which is how we are in the world. You know, we end up killing each other and invading countries and stealing and lying and yada, yada, yada. All these things that we do as humans. And yet, how, therefore, do we get closer to this fortress? How do we get through it? How do we get free of this? And this, of course, is part of the practice as well. It's a huge thing just to get to this point, to realize that we're stuck in this story that we've created in order to keep ourselves safe, to function. And we have to start going closer to that fortress to try and open it. And initially, the fortress will be very suspicious of this. The mind will be very suspicious of this because all of a sudden it's trying to keep us safe. And if we're trying to mess with the system, so to speak, it will try and scare us off. It'll try and go, no, no, you're not going there. You know, keep back. Or it can even give you a peek behind that curtain and scare you off. And that does happen. We've got many sort of stories of this and experiences in retreat centers in particular where people do get frightened in meditation because their mind is sort of going, you're getting a bit too close to something that we can't deal with. So how do we deal with this? And a lot of this practice becomes fascinating, how really subtle, but at how beautiful it is at the same time. Because what the mind really wants deep down is to be safe and happy and well and protected. Ironically, all the things that we wish when we practice for metta, may I be happy, may I be well, da 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 da. These are all the things that the mind truly wants. And when we wish them for ourselves and for others, the barriers soften a bit. It feels more at ease. The mind feels it can trust us more, especially when we keep the precepts. We do things that make us happy. We practice generosity. We might do beautiful things in life and fill our life with beautiful moments. And the mind feels more comfortable with us, more confident with us. It feels that we're not a risk, you know, because it doesn't know how to deal with its troubles, but it knows that we don't know either. So it's kind of balancing things both ways. But if it sees that we're more a steady personality, so to speak, it can relax a bit more. It doesn't have to be so afraid. We no longer become the enemy of ourselves. And that's a big thing to be able to tell the mind, I'm not your enemy. It's okay. And slowly, slowly, the mind opens up more. The fortress dissolves more. We become more free. And at the same time, the mind becomes more open to seeing things as they are, because it doesn't have to be so afraid of things. It doesn't have to be so afraid of the impermanence. It doesn't have to be so afraid of the uncertainty. It can start to understand that this is how it is. And we reach this point in the practice, not through the intellectual saying that everything's impermanent, or the belief that everything is impermanent, and all these things that we tell ourselves. It's seeing and knowing things as they really are, which we do through a compassionate and wise place, a very mature and stable place, a very rational and calm place, that we can see it together and not be afraid. And the more we do this, the less it becomes frightening, the more we can accept that this is normal, this is life. And our priorities shift. We're no longer trying to fight off the world. We're no longer trying to fight each other to protect myself and everything else, because there's no point. We can see that this is not going to work. There's a better way of doing this. We get a deeper understanding of the situation, and so we know how to deal with it. That fear starts to disappear. And that's so much how the practice starts to develop, because this too is just the beginning. It's all about developing these skills, developing all these things. And all of a sudden, the precepts, practicing generosity, all these things are going, oh yes, it's very nice and spiritual and blah, blah, blah. Oh yes, very virtuous, da, 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 da. All of a sudden, these become beautiful things. They become very functional things, very useful things. You know, they become wonderful things, because the mind itself feels stable, it feels comfortable, it feels happy with this. And it kind of feels that, you know, it's almost like we betray ourselves when we lie and cheat and steal and do all these things. We destroy ourselves when we hurt other people because we are in pain, you know, like a wild animal in pain, how it lashes out and attacks something else. We too do that. And we can start to realize that we don't have to do that. We don't have to be afraid of the bigger picture. Because the Four Noble Truths really are nothing but the cold, hard facts of life and how to deal with them. And so much of the Buddhist practice is being able to be more confident, more able, and build that inner strength so we can see these things and not have to be afraid of them. So much of our meditation is trying to get away from this. We want to be happy. We want to go into deep meditation. We want to experience all these wonderful, lovely states. You know, or we don't want to have unpleasant meditation. We don't want to have an unpleasant life. You know, and if we can't get these things, we run off into distractions. TV, internet, shopping, all these things of which we've become very sophisticated at. A huge array, a buffet of choices of how we can escape. And yet, none of it works. All we get is a credit card bill. And then we have to work some more to pay off the credit card bill. And away we go, on and on and on. It's becoming confident that we can see this situation and going, yes, it doesn't work. And fine, that's okay. But we have another way of dealing with it. All of a sudden, we have so much happiness in our life, we don't need to look for it elsewhere. We have so much peace in our lives through meditation, we don't need to go running and searching and climbing the Himalayas or whatever. It's right here. The Buddha is not in Thailand. It's not in some distant place. It's wherever you are. The Dharma is wherever you are, and freedom is wherever you are. And that is so wonderful. And that liberates us so much that we don't have to try to do this path. The practice starts to take care of itself because it starts to make sense. The heart and the intellect, the compassion and the wisdom start to come together. The mindfulness and wisdom start to come together because these things just make sense in the moment. And again and again and again, the more we meditate and feel these peaceful experiences, the more we feel that there is another way. It is a better way to chill out and relax sometimes and to clear the mind so we can see clearly. So we're not running around afraid or, you know, being sold on some crazy idea that buying this car or going on this holiday or wearing these clothes or wearing this perfume or whatever is going to make everything okay and wonderful. Of course it won't. I mean, it's a strange story. It's probably a couple of years ago, I was visiting family and helping them clear out some stuff and found some old books, sales magazines, which had some pictures of some cars, basically an advert for a car from the 1970s. And it's this hideous box of a thing, tank, ugly car. And you're looking and going, no way would we want this today. But back then, people really lusted after that. They really, you know, would love, imagine themselves driving in this thing, you know, as if that would make them happy. And now we can look at it going, come on, what were we thinking? No way would we go for that today. And of course, this is like how the practice works. All these things which we run to when we don't know how to deal with our life troubles, all these things that we wish will give us happiness or believe will give us happiness, we now know through practice that they will never give us happiness and that we don't need them. And that's where the liberation starts to come in. We start to live our own lives and it starts to become far more enjoyable. Because it's far less that we need to run around to get, far less that we have to do, because we can't change the universe. We can only change how we relate to the universe, how we interact with the world, because we're not separate from it. And of course, these are these bigger things that we can see more clearly, because part of this fortress is to block those experiences out. Is to block the seeing of these things from our lives. Yathā Bhūta Jñāna Dasana, we're trying to see these things clearly, and yet there's this vested interest that we don't see these things clearly because the mind deep down doesn't know how to deal with it when we do. But now it does, and it's not afraid to see them. And it knows that it doesn't have to worry about us, so to speak. It knows that the ego isn't going to take over and, you know, barge in and try and demand this and fix this and take over that and do all kinds of crazy stuff. It doesn't have to worry about that. And it can see all these things which are going on all around us, all the time, and that they've always been here. But at the same time, the freedom has always been here as well. And we can rest more in the meditation. We can enjoy the meditation more. We enjoy being a good person more. Because why not? You know, all the time before, there's always this gamble, you know, oh, you know, how do I know this is going to pay off? I'm making an investment here. I'm putting all this time and effort in. When is this going to pay off? There's none of that anymore because the whole idea of a payoff makes no sense. But you only really get there when you can start to open up that fortress. And together, see things and know things clearly. So, hopefully that's a little Dharma talk to start us off with. Shall we move into the meditation and get on to the good stuff?
That sounds wonderful. Thank you, Venerable.
Wonderful. Okay, as usual, everyone please stand up and give yourself a bit of a stretch and adjust your clothes and do all the things you need to do so we can settle into our meditation. It's always good to loosen up because we've already been sitting for half an hour, but at the same time, after a day's work, we're pretty tired and stiff anyway. So having a nice stretch really does help to settle the body in. And so, when you're ready, please take a seat, settle in, and close your eyes. And just get a feel of yourself in the chair, in the room, in the context of where you are. You're in a safe place, a comfortable place. A place where you can relax and where you can be yourself. And keep relaxing the body and adjust the posture as you need it. Doesn't it feel good to relax and settle? Doesn't it feel good just to leave the world outside? And as you relax, just imagine what it would be like to rest in the breath. The breath calms you down. And you help the breath to calm down. The mind loves to be engaged. It likes to be occupied. So the occupation is just to be with the breath. Just a time of simplicity. If this is too simple for the mind, because the mind can be overstimulated, you can simply note in your mind, breathing in and relaxing, breathing out and relaxing, like a mantra. But if you don't need it, you don't have to use it. And now as we move towards the end of the meditation, imagine a feeling of metta. May I be happy. May I be well. May I be safe. Isn't that what the heart truly wants? Imagine sending that feeling of kindness through the keyhole of the fortress into your own heart. May we be happy. May we be well. And may we be safe. And imagine that feeling filling the entire fortress, filling the entire heart, so we can lower the fortress walls, lower the firewalls. And we can be free. And imagine sharing that same feeling to those you love. May they be happy. May they be well and safe and free. And finally send that feeling to everyone. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe and well. May all beings be free. And I'll now ring the gong. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. Welcome back.
Indeed, welcome back, Venerable. Thank you. most peaceful.
I'm happy.
And happy. Venerable, we've had a couple of our members go on retreat, one with Ajahn Brahm in Phuket, and two with Ajahn Brumali recently. I was just wondering whether we might call on them to tell us a little bit about their retreats if they feel like it. If you're comfortable, please.
Please.
Yes, the retreats are a most wonderful thing to undertake. Very positive side of practice, I get the impression. Well, maybe later, Venerable. Would you like to answer questions, or would you like to continue with your talk?
No, questions.
Okay, well, I've just got a little announcement here. Tonight we'd like to remind you that the monks are here to help with meditation and Buddhism. Many of us struggle in different ways and areas, hence the need for many of us to seek out solutions through meditation and spirituality. The monks' time with us is short, and their personal qualifications go no further than meditation and Buddhism. So, please phrase your questions accordingly, and thank you. Please feel welcome to comment on. Thank you, Gloria. It's very nice to see you here with us this evening.
Thank you very much for the talk. Your talk reminds me. Last night, I hear a talk that has a great title. It said, the right effort is no effort. And I think what you said is like aligned with that. And sometimes it's quite inspiring because for most of my life, I spent a lot of effort doing different things. So my question is that how to develop more patience, because Buddha says that patience is a very, very important quality in your spiritual life. And I want to ask how to develop more patience in your practice as well as like in your daily life when you have like facing different kind of people and different kind of situation. Thank you.
There's a lot of ways we can develop patience, and you're exactly right. It is very, very important in Buddhism. A lot of it can come from the compassion side, a lot of it can come from the wisdom side, many different ways we can approach it. Generally, as we practice more, we start to see people experiencing much the same things we do. We're in the same situation that they are a lot of the times. They're looking for happiness, they're looking for safety, fulfillment, all the things that we would want. And a lot of the times they don't understand how to deal with their own problems, and they cause all kinds of difficulties that spread out into other people's lives. And understanding that they're struggling themselves in the same way that we are gives a huge amount of patience, because all of a sudden it's not like they're coming to get us and we have to protect ourselves and everything else. And we recognize all kinds of things. There's a spaciousness that we get with the meditation as well, that we don't have to be confined to our own little trouble, our own little bubble of the world. Because that's another thing is, you know, we're so busy at work, we're so busy with what we have to deal with, all these things we try to do, all these achievements we're expected to get to please our parents, our family, our society, da-da-da-da-da. And anyone who kind of encroaches on that into our problems with their problems, we often respond very badly. And so finding that space, that the right effort is no effort. Patience doesn't need effort. It's so wonderful. We can develop it so easily. But it takes time. And that's part of the thing as well. To be patient is to give time. And to give time to everyone. So we could be here for hours talking about this. Patience is a wonderful subject, but hopefully that little bit helps.
Indeed, patience. Oh, Venerable. I have a comment on the retreats here. I would love to attend the retreat at Jhana Grove in future. I've just come back from the Phuket executive retreat with Ajahn Brahm, which was wonderful. But I've heard that it's more serious than the executive retreat. Would you like to comment?
Serious? How, sorry? Is in the Jhana Grove ones are more serious?
Or the Jhana Grove ones may be more serious than the executive retreat in Phuket with Ajahn Brahm?
It can be. I mean, it entirely depends on the audience. Ajahn and pretty much all good Dharma teachers and meditation teachers are always sensitive to the audience and really what they need. Sometimes we think that this would be a great thing to talk about this and try this and da-da-da-da, and it's completely not relevant to the audience, and so we just won't use it. It doesn't feel right for the situation. So we talk to something that is relevant. And so in my observation, the Jhana Grove ones are very easygoing. The main point that we have with the retreats that we find over and over and over is that people are worn out, they're very busy in their lives, busy with their work and everything else. And to deal with their troubles, they throw themselves into distractions, into news, into media, into shopping and movies and data. So they're burnt out and they're overstimulated at the same time. So they come into the retreats exhausted. And so a lot of the time, which Ajahn does, which is really good, is he says for the first few days, sleep in, relax, get your energy back, come back to the moment, and then really we start the retreat. I suppose it can be more serious on, say, the Rains retreat with the monastics, because it's a full-time retreat and it lasts for, you know, a couple of months, and it's a few weeks away and really looking forward to it. Wonderful. Serious isn't really the right word, I think, because serious can be more, you know, in-depth rather than intense. So that's probably something closer to the mark. But Ajahn is well known. He doesn't force things on people. And that's a very good thing, because there are times that we try to force Dharma down people's throats, you know, and whack them on the head that you should think like this and you should be like that and da-da-da-da-da. And, of course, that just makes people more stressed, more tired, more afraid to meditate, and it just does not work. So if you can get into a Jhana Grove retreat, great. They're wonderful. If you can't, have a treat at home. Take the weekend off and, you know, prepare your food so you don't have to worry about it and, you know, shut the door and lock it. And be free. And have your own retreat. And that's well worth it. So that's a little bit.
A nice taste. Thank you very much, Venerable. Venerable, we have a question in the chat along the same lines. About your talk tonight about the mind and distraction. When the mind is clouded with anxiety or depressing states, it is difficult to face it in meditation because it feels unbearable. What strategy can we do instead of running away from it through distraction, like going on movies or holidays?
Ultimately, the important thing is to recognize that it is unbearable. Is that the need to get away from the experience is a normal, healthy, rational response. The problem is we don't understand yet that it doesn't work, and we don't understand yet that there is another way that we can act on this. So a lot of meditation practice at the beginning, particularly more for monastics, is to sit with the experience. No matter how painful it is to learn to sit with it, to be with it, to not be afraid of it. and at the same time to develop that compassion and wisdom. So there's a little bit of this endurance thing going on, but it's not kind of endurance as in, you know, being tough and, you know, staring it down kind of thing. It's more sort of the being able to recognize that the pain is there, the anxiety is there, the anger, the fear, the resentment, the whatever the emotion is, it is there, and that's okay. And the moment we realize that it's okay to have human emotions, we can then feel that we don't need to run away with it. Instead, we can now respond to it compassionately, respond to it wisely, investigate it more. Where is this coming from? Is there something we can do about it? We can perhaps improve in some ways. Maybe we can't, and we can accept that. And so gradually, we build up that inner strength. But certainly, yes, for many beginners, there's, you know, we feel pain in our meditational distractions, and straight away we want to push it out, we want to make it go away, we want a solution, we want. And that is what Ajahn Brahm calls second noble truth meditation, as in suffering meditation. Whereas really it's the letting go that is really what we're going towards. But we can't let it go until we can relax and be with it. So, ironically, saying being patient is a major part of it, of course, but we don't have to push it. We don't have to be in a hurry to go anywhere. And it's okay. So hope that helps.
Thank you, Venerable. I'm sure it does. Is there anybody else who... Oh, yes, Gita, would you like to unmute? It's lovely to hear from you.
Yes, Bhakti. Am I unmuted now, Prince?
Yes, you are. We can hear you beautifully.
Yeah. Bhante, that was really something that resonated with me when you spoke about the doubt, you know, is this a right practice? Am I going in the right direction? How do I know? And it's after many years of practice, I find that at the moment there's this huge wave of doubt or questioning that I'm grappling with, and I'm watching it, and it just does throw you off a bit, you know. So it was good to hear that, you know, that people struggle with this. You just think that after some years you kind of worked out that maybe this was the right path and you just stay with it. But no, it slips away sometimes.
Mm. Yeah. And the thing is that the more we go into it, the bigger all this becomes. It's like we start to see these little patches behind the curtain, and we find that the picture was far bigger than we could have possibly imagined, and we don't know how to deal with that. And more doubts sort of come in. Are we doing the right thing? You know, maybe it's better to shut those curtains and forget about all this. Lock the door and throw away the key and turn back on the TV. But as we go on, we kind of feel that, you know, turning on the TV feels like we're selling out in a way. It feels like we're, you know, giving up on the wrong things. And that can be useful. That can be beneficial to us, because we experience turning on the TV and going, well, I just spent 2 hours watching this movie and, I would like to have those 2 hours of my life back. You know, all of a sudden we can value the meditation more. We can be a bit more brave with the doubts, and a bit more open to seeing what's behind that curtain, behind the fortress. And it's a wonderful journey.
One of the things is that I find that it's difficult to function in the normal world. So then I think, oh dear, you know, should I be doing this? Because I can't do things in the way that I did, or with the same interest, and I mean, certainly not at the same speed.
Mm-hmm.
So you think, oh, I can't function anymore. And this is because of this practice. Mm. So what should I be doing about that?
Oh no, this is a great point, because this is exactly the vested interest that we're functioning on. We have this very strong vested interest to function, to be able to cope in the world, to be able to survive. And we've got this long list of coping mechanisms that we've built up over the years. And as, exactly as you say, the moment we start meditating and practicing, we don't feel the attraction for those anymore. But there's that little bit going, well, what am I going to do without them? I need them. And we start to be with that experience, to be with that fear, and have loving kindness for that fear, because it's okay. It's really enriching to do that. But it's wonderful to sort of see that it's exactly these vested interests. We need to go deeper into that fear. What are we afraid of so much? That it will all fall apart? It was always going to fall apart.
It's interesting you mentioned the loving kindness, because that's something I've never really felt drawn to, that practice. But now suddenly it's popping up as something useful and something that I'm wanting to develop.
Yeah.
It's sort of slowly, it's just crept in somehow. And maybe, as you said, it's needed now.
Yeah. This is the thing, is that when the heart feels alone, threatened, that it can't cope, and it doesn't feel like you're a friend to yourself, it can't trust you, it can't be with you, it builds up that prison because it feels it has no other option. And yet all of a sudden, when that loving kindness and that compassion and that joy and living a good life, it wants to be with you more. It's happier, it feels safer, it feels more open with you. And you get that feedback that comes in more and more. And the loving kindness does become useful. It's not just some thing we do to be good little Buddhists. It becomes such a wonderful, you know, way to open the heart.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Venerable, would it be safe to say that opening the heart is probably never wrong?
Ooh, that
because
one's...
I find as a teacher, Venerable, that even if I open my heart in the most difficult of situations, the response back is usually one of kindness.
Yeah. That is a reflection that you have been practicing. Because for a lot of people, and they're not there yet, to tell them to open the heart, they'll be going, no, no way, not going there, no, shut that down. It feels vulnerable. And so to open the heart, to open the fortress when it feels especially vulnerable, can be a terrifying experience. So in the big picture, it's opening the heart is always a good thing. But we usually have to be a bit more sensitive to the person when that's right and when that's an appropriate time to do. Because, of course, that's the goal. But, you know, unfortunately, we can't get there in a single step. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Venerable. Is there anybody else who would like to ask a question, unmute, or ask a question? Or we have another new message in the chat, just one moment. Yes, I'm not quite sure what it is. Just a moment. I think I might have another question waiting back here. I'm sorry, everyone. Is there anybody else who would like to speak while I look back through the chat?
No, I love Gita's comments. That was really interesting. I haven't been practicing as long as you have, but one thing I've noticed a lot is that just accepting things makes things better. I have no idea why, but it just seems to help.
Yeah, and that's actually a big part of it, because a huge part of what we're working towards is accepting things as they are, but to accept the whole package, to accept everything. And this is the thing, is that when we can't accept, when we must feel we must resist, protect ourselves, shut this out, make it go away, make it be something else, that tightens the fortress, that makes us feel more tense inside. And so accepting is always relaxing. And it's always, it's a wonderful practice. If you if that's the direction your mind is taking you, wonderful. Please keep doing it, because it's a wonderful thing. Other people, opening the heart might be loving kindness, it might be compassion, it might be joy, it might be all different kinds of ways of doing it, faith, devotion, etc., etc. Loads of different ways. The Buddha taught 40 different meditation styles, but they're all, because we're all different. We have so much in common, but what we need is a slightly different recipe for each of us. And learning what we really need is a journey, and it's well worth it. So, wonderful.
Thank you, Venerable. Is there another question? Somebody has their hand raised. Martha, you have your hand raised. Would you like to ask a question about meditation?
Yes, I'm still struggling with the delusion, my ignorance about anger looking for me. And so when I'm doing, I attend a lot of different meditations because I enjoy them so much, and also the people mm-hmm. who are there working on it also. I am just wondering if there's any guidance about, for example, when we did the at the end of today's meditation, sending metta to yourself, getting through the fortress of your own self to give it to yourself, and then give it to, very easy to give it, for me to give it to loved ones, wishing that they are happy and well. But I am truly still struggling with wanting people who put me in a very precarious situation. I promise you this, I know what I did. It's not that I have to, I promise you, I've hurt people terribly, but I have not taken away their livelihood. I haven't taken away their ability to have children. I haven't taken away their ability to support their children or support their families, but I'm wanting to. In my mind, I would never do that, but I am honestly feeling that way. I'm just wondering if when I'm going to various meditation groups and they're asking me to put myself in there for loving kindness, the ones who are easy to love for loving kindness, a neutral person for loving kindness, and then someone who's not particular, who I'm having difficulty with, is it bad for me to be? What should I do when all that anger comes up and I'm not ready to do that? I don't know if you have some guidance about that, Venerable. If you can tell me what to do when I'm in those meditation groups and I'm repeatedly being asked to bring someone into my heart and send them loving kindness, as in loving kindness. The only way I can conceptualize it is I can take it to the whole earth, because I do want the earth to be at peace. And that's when I'm not personalizing it. Mm-hmm. And I know that if they were happy, they wouldn't have been so heinous. But they did. And yeah. I'm sorry. Can you help me?
Sure. The standard format is really a serving suggestion, right? It's not a hard, fast, one-size-fits-all. And this is a very, very important thing to understand, is generally speaking, when we teach meditation, we kind of stick with a routine pattern to try to make it universal, even though deep down we have to understand it isn't universal. We have so much in common, but what we need will be different from person to person. So we have the right, you know, it's very, very good to be very skeptical of magical methods and marvelous techniques and one-size-fits-all solutions, because they might help some, but they might not help others. So when it comes to the big issue, maybe we can give it to ourselves, maybe we can't. Maybe we, giving it to loved ones is very easy. It's pretty much a universal one. And sometimes we focus on developing that emotion and making that stronger and stronger and stronger just on those loved ones, and then spreading it to more neutral people and or ourselves in whatever pattern works for you. Eventually, the goal, right, not necessarily that you're a bad person if you can't do this, the goal is to spread it to everybody in a non-abstract way, even the people who are so monstrous in this world and do such terrible things, because they are human. They are human. And so it's very, very difficult. But it's not to blame ourselves that we can't forgive them or accept them or anything else. It's to recognize that we can't. And that's okay. You know, it's the problem we have in a lot of meditation systems is that it's kind of because we present it as sort of this one-size-fits-all system and we can't do it, we kind of feel a failure that something's wrong with us, when the system isn't necessarily in the right sequence for us. We might not be ready for this. It's always getting to where you're at. And it's okay to feel angry with people. It's very human. And we are human. But we have to, at the same time, recognize and get to a point when we see that this anger doesn't serve anyone. It doesn't help us. It doesn't help them. It doesn't help anyone, even though they're doing wrong. And in this situation, when we look at how our actions affect our mind, they're destroying themselves. They're poisoning their own lives. And because they're suffering from that, they're going out and doing more deadly things. They've destroyed their own chance of happiness in this life, and so they're destroying other people. And so recognizing how that delusion functions in their own mind, slowly we start to recognize that they are human. And so it's difficult to try and, you know, particularly in the Western culture, so to say, is that there's this ancient cultural thing we have is to love our friends and to harm our enemies, right? And not forgive our enemies. And that worked for the ancient Greeks. That worked for... Yeah. You got a big smile there. Obviously, you understand. Right. And so, gradually we move away from that. We realize that it's just not going to help us. It's not going to help anyone. But there's no hurry. There's no hurry to love everyone. And if we try to be in a hurry to love everyone, we will never succeed. Because we're putting pressure on it, we're putting deadlines, we're putting on expectations, etc., etc., etc. You know, isn't love, loving kindness, compassion, something that comes without boundaries, without expectations? Isn't that what true loving kindness is? We have to be there to know that. But that takes time when we're ready for that. So this is a very, very big conversation, and we could be here for a very long time. So I hope this helps.
Yes, thank you so much. Human and Venerable.
Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Martha. And thank you, Venerable. Martha and Venerable, we do have a couple of other talks, questions here, and time's running short. So here's one from the chat. Thank you for the wonderful talk, as always, Venerable. I was wondering why tears started rolling down while I was meditating. Could it be the stress? I'm relaxed and feeling well after the meditation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing to do that. When it happens on its own, it's a sign that deep inside your heart and your mind realizes that this is what we need. And there's this relief. We can cry tears of relief, tears of joy, tears of, finally, this is what we need. And so that's a wonderful thing. So, hooray.
Thank you, Venerable. Tina, you've had your hand up for a while. Would you like to still ask your question or make a comment?
Yeah, I'm making a comment thanks, Venerable, what you say about patience and loving kindness. I hope this is something that will help you too, because I raised a question with Ajahn Brahmani when you visited Singapore. It's like, how do I love and have loving kindness to people that I really cannot love, that drive me up the wall when I interact with them?
Mm-hmm.
So what he shared was very useful for me, and I hope for the rest of you who have same problem. Basically, he said that, yes, it's true for beginners like us. It's very hard to love everybody, especially those that drive us up the wall. But he said, view it from a compassionate perspective. Have compassion for them because they know not better. They have not found a way to be kind, to be more humane. So once I, at least for me, when I practice compassion towards this group of people, I find myself softer,
mm-hmm.
and actually loving kindness is easier to attain in the near future, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope that helps too. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tina. There's actually a lovely comment in the chat that I'll just read for you. Anger is stressful. Forgiveness is a virtue. Loving kindness meditation has enabled me to be calm, forgive, and send metta to those who caused anger and stressful emotion in me years ago.
That's nice.
So, it's very nice. So, Venerable, would you like to finish with a blessing for everyone this evening?
Nāti me saranang anyang buddho me saranang warang ete na satya waje na sotite ho tu sabada. Nāti me saranang anyang dhammo me saranang warang ete na satya waje na sotite ho tu sabada. Nāti me saranang anyang sangho me saranang warang ete na satya waje na sotite ho tu sabada. Thank you for having me.